welcome to a historic version of Nocturnal General tonight, live from Willie Dixon's Blues Heaven at the Historic Chess Studios. That was 2120. That's my David Letterman moment. That's good. So we've got a whole bunch, a boatload of guests. We've got some live music from the Cashbox Kings. I'm Dave Hoekstra, and let's just start right off with Jackie Dixon. Thanks for having us, the president of Blues Heaven.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
And we've known each other for a long time. Can you briefly talk about why we're here? Let's talk about phase one, what you did when you got the building, phase two, and what's coming up in phase three.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to say that Dave is the first journalist that actually gave me credibility. This is my first real interview when he was with the newspaper. So since then, we've had a few conversations about the different phases that we're doing for Blues Heaven. We're in phase three now, which is where we ultimately wanted to get to. Phase one began in 1992, actually after my dad passed. My mom began looking for a location for the foundation, and in 93, Phil Chess, the younger brother of Leonard Chess, called, and I actually took the call, and he said that the building was available and that we should try to acquire it. He knew that my dad was interested in it, and he felt he deserved it. So from there, phase one began, which was my mom acquiring the building, the restoration. They took a lot of donations. She made some private investments towards it. She purchased it, restored it, and then donated it to the foundation. So it's owned by the foundation now.
Paint a picture, before we go to phase two, paint a picture for the listeners of the room we're in right now and what happened here.
Okay.
We're on the second floor.
Right. This is the this was actually the studio. It had panelings up when Chess was here. That the rear portion was more of a storage area and for extra equipment and instruments. And then there were two doors, and it was a wall that separated here. But this is where the recordings took place, in this room.
And our band loaded in tonight the same way they did back in the day. Talk about that.
Right. Okay, so the musicians entered through the rear staircase. It was easy access from the alley. So all the blues musicians that came in to record would enter that way. And when other people would come to audition, they would enter through the front stairs, and they would meet, actually, Minnie Riperton at the at the front counter. She was the receptionist here, and she would give them a have them wait until they could get a chance to audition.
And in some of the books I've written, we always talk about how a place isn't a place until it's remembered. What are your earliest memories of this? When were you first in here?
Actually, I was never in here until my mom purchased the
okay.
building. We had driven past a lot of times. I was actually on the bus, and I saw this place, and I knew that my dad had been part of this when it was a studio. I knew that he had expressed an interest in it, and he began the process of trying to acquire it, and then it kind of fell apart, and so a little politics. And so I knew that it was a place that he desired to own, but I wasn't sure that it would ever happen.
And what turned around? How did it happen?
Like I said, Phil Chess made us aware that it was available. The person that owned it before, I guess he was just, you know, having a difficult time maintaining a space of this size. And also, you know, it had kind of started to deteriorate quite a bit over the years. It had been used in different ways, rented out for parties. And I think there was a disco ball in the ceiling here where they were using it as a club, and I guess it was a dance studio at one point, and a lot of things had already been removed from the original structure. So
phase three, that's what's going to go on in phase three now.
Yeah, so phase three is where we got the studio up, which was my dad's dream. He's never lived anywhere or had any property that didn't have a studio in it. When we lived on the south side in off of Troop Street, we had a studio in the basement. And then he had Soul Productions on 77th and Racine, and that was the Blues Factory. And then we, where we lived in California, we had a studio in the garage. So he always had a place where he could record and make music and create. So naturally, when we acquired this place, putting the studio in was a definite first mission, but we had to get to phase one and two first.
And so we have Glenn Forrest on the panel.
How you doing?
Thanks for joining us, Glenn. So you're the chief engineer here at Blues Heaven.
Yes, I am.
So tell us about the work you've been doing in restoring the studio.
We got in here about 2 months ago and brought in a bunch of gear here from New York, actually. And we've been setting it up and checking the room and just making it happen, you know.
And did you, I was asking, did you research? Did you talk to, you know, did you do research on Ron Malo and some of the people who worked in here?
Absolutely.
What vibes did you pick up?
Absolutely. I mean, just a lot of research on recording techniques and obviously just listening to a lot of the music that was done here.
And so tell us what you've done in the room, what type of gear you have, you got an analog recording.
Oh, yeah. We're looking to restore the space to, you know, circa 1965, mid-60s type of recording techniques, so analog tape and tons of tube equipment and ribbon mics and stuff like that, you know.
And it will be open to the public this summer?
Yeah, we're hoping to get open, to be open by June or the 1st of June, hopefully by the Blues Fest, that we'll do our first recording.
And anybody can record here? How, you know, bands, musicians in need? Talk about your game plan.
Well, one of the plans for Blues Heaven, one of the programs, is to give local musicians or any musician that's in need of studio time an opportunity to come in, because our rate is going to be a little bit higher because it is a historical studio. And so not everybody will have the opportunity to record here at their own expense. So what we're going to do is a program that will allow them to come in and do a demo, maybe get a couple hours. So we're still working on that.
And who all has recorded? There's been stuff done here. People have been portable. We were talking about it. They've run in portable gear. I think maybe did Ron Wood or somebody do that?
Yeah, what we had was, the first person to come in and record here, I believe, was Styx. They came in and they brought a trailer with all of their equipment outside. And it was Styx with Coco Taylor and Johnny Johnson from Chuck Berry's keyboard player. And then after that, Steve Jordan, the drummer for Eric Clapton, and he's with the John Mayer trio. And so he came in with Pino Palladino, Ron Woods. They brought in, what's his name? That was the guitar player for Howlin' Wolf.
Hubert Sumlin?
Hubert, yeah. They brought in Hubert. He was so exhausted that he asked my mom if he could leave. And so she hailed him a taxi and let him go back to the hotel. But they came in and he recorded with his own band, The Verbs, so that was after. And they brought in some equipment. There wasn't a full gear like what we have, but it was just set up in the back part of the studio.
You're in for a treat. The Cashbox Kings, they sound, we heard them during soundcheck. They sound really, really, really good.
They were great.
It'll be great. Tim Samuelson, City of Chicago historian. Thanks for joining us, Tim, on Nocturnal Journal.
Well, thanks for having me here.
And so tell us what, you have such an insight into the building. Tell us a little bit about the history of the building, when it was built, its original use.
Well, the building goes back to 1911, when it was the most unglamorous place for selling automobile tires. This was the old Motor Row, and then over the years, they did things like make upholstery slipcovers in here. Not the place that you would expect to turn the music business on its end. But in 1956, this building was bought by the Chess Brothers as their first modern headquarters. Now, you know, Capitol Records has their big fancy L.A. building shaped like a stack of discs and with all their fancy consultants and whatnot. And here's this little building that was like the middle of nowhere. And they kind of fix it up a little bit in the front, you know, the best the 1950s have to offer. But they're also able to have, for their first time, their own permanent studio. And you could then get the musicians to come in. And unlike you're at a commercial studio where you're kind of on the clock, the musicians could kind of hang around and talk and discuss and actually get a performance that would be close to what you would have in a live club. Nobody's hurrying you. And it was great. I mean, for the original sound engineer, Jack Weiner, in fact, we met him, and he was like a 20-year-old techno geek. And it was a case of where Leonard Chess, he had him wire his house for hi-fi. He says, hey, you want to build out my studio? And so he did. In fact, it was what he called Sheldon Recording Studios, because he also did his own sessions up here. Hand-built the consoles. We were able to take him through. And a lot of our recollections of what were here were based on what he found. And we even went scrounging old parts at the old Universal Studios.
It was a destination point, too. Both of you can talk about that. I mean, Chuck Berry drove here, and there's a story I remember, Ike and Tina Turner parking in front. And stuff.
Yeah, I mean, everyone who was
sought this place out.
Yeah, I mean, it was a place that was a place you wanted to record. I mean, this is why the Rolling Stones sought out the place. That's why you have a instrumental, 2120 South Michigan Avenue. That's a love song to this building. They came here, but the people who were in here, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, Howlin' Wolf, and to even hear not only the recordings that were made here, but even some of the off takes. I mean, I think I even did a description of some of those. I have the honor of being the first person ever bleeped on the History Channel by giving some of the recounting of what went on in this very studio, and I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yeah. We were looking at the pictures downstairs. I mean, there was a lot of cigarette smoking and just, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were restoring the studio. Yeah. We would get different musicians who were here originally to give their critique. Does it look like what you remember? And we asked Bo Diddley, and he said, well, there's something really wrong with this place. And I thought, uh-oh. He said, it's too clean. You have to bring people in here with cigarettes and have them stub them out into the walls and leave the butts on the floor. Then you'll have an authentic restoration.
So, Jackie, on Facebook today, I told you you teed up my questions and stuff. But number three is, what's Jackie doing with the business since her mom passed? I know you lost your mom recently, and this, right. She was very, very obviously into this. Yeah. So how has that transition been for you?
It's been very interesting because a lot of people didn't know I even existed. Mm-hmm. You know, I was kind of behind the scenes, and my mom was the front person. So a lot of times she would, you know, I would get things ready for her. But she had met so many people, had such a huge influence on so many people. She advised musicians all the time. You know, she was there to help in so many ways. And so people kind of expect the same of me, and I do the best I can.
Okay, we're going to pick up on that. We're going to take a break. So don't go away from Blues Heaven Chess Studios at 2120 South Michigan.
You're deceiving, and I can't stand you creeping. I'm gone. I'm tired of your deceiving, and I can't stand you creeping. I'm gone. Too late, too late, too late. I can't stand you cooking, and you ain't good looking. I'm gone. I can't stand you cooking, and you ain't good looking. I'm gone. Gee, you know I love you, and I don't know just why. I thought the whole world loved you, but today I say bye-bye, bye-bye. Too late, too late, too late. I'm tired of all the fussing, and I can't stand you cussing. I'm gone. I'm tired of all the fussing, and I can't stand you cussing. I'm gone. Too late, too late, too late. To the top, fella. Yeah. Bye-bye, bye-bye. Too late, too late, too late. I'm tired of your deceiving, and I can't stand you creeping. I'm gone. I can't stand your cooking and you ain't good looking. I'm gone. I'm tired of all the fussing and I can't stand your cussing. I'm gone. Too late, too late, too late. Too late.
Right there, the Castbox Kings. Willie Dixon's Too Late. Joe, covered by Little Walter.
Little Walter.
What do you know about that song? We got about a minute before we break for the news, but talk about what you know.
I know Willie Dixon was one of the authors of that song, and Little Walter popularized it and recorded it. I'm not quite sure. There's probably people in this room that know 1954-ish.
Before this place. Yeah.
Hey, I remember a lot of people being told you can't stand your cookies and you ain't good looking. I'm out. Gotta be able to cook that barnyard pimp, I tell you.
Very good. Very good. That's what I like. That's good stuff. You guys got a gig tomorrow night at Space?
We will be at Space in Evanston tomorrow night, 7:30, double bill with a great band called the Jimmies, a horn-driven R&B band. And if you're in the north side, Evanston area, come on and check us out. Cashbox Kings, would love to see you. We'll be starting early, 7:30 on a Sunday night, so you get home to bed in time to get up for Monday morning work. So.
And that's Oscar Wilson on vocals. Thank you, Oscar.
Well,
and we're
going
to back talk to the band after the 10 o'clock hour. So we're going to take a break here for the news. And then we got a special guest after the 9:30 news. Is Mitty Collier, who recorded here. Right, Mitty?
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to get to you early because you got church tomorrow, right? Okay, all right. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal live from Blues Heaven Foundation.
Me buzz. You the one who really gives me buzz. I didn't think I could last much longer, but you show you just how wrong I was. Now as I turn on my radio to hear the latest news, they made me feel so bad they wouldn't play the lonesome blues. You're the one who really gives me buzz. I didn't think I could last much longer, but show you just how wrong I was.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. I'm Dave Hoekstra, and that's the Cashbox Kings, and we're live from the Blues Heaven Foundation Chess Studios, 2120 South Michigan. We have a special guest. You got to go to church tomorrow, right?
Right.
Pastor Mitty Collier, you're recording. Thank you so much for joining us, Pastor.
Nobody but you. Nobody but you, Dave, to get me to come out here tonight.
A rough night. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming. Tell us, I mean, you were here in the mid-60s.
No, 1959. 1959,
but okay.
Mm-hmm.
And how long were you here?
Till 1969.
And what all did you record here?
Well, we started off with I Gotta Get Away From It All. And then we went to I Had a Talk with God Last Night. No Faith, No Love, Sharing You. I could go on and on. Come Back, Baby. I did some of Ray Charles' songs here. And it was quite fascinating to be here. Different from what it was, what it is today. When once somebody messed up, everybody had to start over, you know, because we were all on the same board. But I think the most momentous occasion I had here was the band that played here, you know, Maurice White, who with Earth, Wind, and Fire was our drummer, and Louis Satterfield was our bass player, Gerald Sims, who later came in this building, and I recorded a gospel song for him, and also Leonard Caston. And Leonard played for a church. And when he came in one day, he gave me some words and said, would you help me with this song? I'm going to teach it to my choir. And the song was Reverend James Cleveland, I Had a Talk with God Last Night. And so I started singing it. He gave me the words, and he was singing it. And I came out of the church so I could whoop some gospel, you know. So I was singing. And so the producer then was Billy Davis. And he came through and said, "What in the world is that?" And we told him, and he went back there in the back studio, and he recorded us rehearsing. And about 2 days later, they called and said, "Get down here early. We got a song for you." And it was "I Had a Talk with My Man." He had changed the words from "I Had a Talk with God" to "I Had a Talk with My Man Last Night."
And that was a big influence on Dusty Springfield. We've talked about that.
Yeah, yeah, she was. Covered it. She did. She covered it, but she couldn't quite cover it. Because when you mentioned "I Had a Talk with My Man," my name comes up because it was my song. And I just don't think anybody can do anybody's song the way the original person can. And so when I went over in Peretta, Italy, people were just following, come from everywhere to see me. You know, and they didn't care whether I was singing "Little Boy Blue, Come Blow Your Horn" or whatever. They just wanted to come, and they had stacks of my 45s for me to autograph. And I autographed enough of them until I got writer's cramp. And I said, "Well, now, you all got to come back tomorrow." And that's what happened. So it was quite interesting in here because we became a family, Dave. Everybody here, and I was here with like Sugar Pie DeSanto, right, and Jackie Ross and Fontella Bass, Sugar Pie DeSanto. All of us were here, the Dales, and we would hang around all day long. We had a certain time to record, so we knew when our record date was coming up. But we stayed around to hear everybody else, what they were doing. And so we sang all day long and sitting on the steps, eating. We didn't
the
have
steps
so
that
much.
People walked up tonight.
Yeah. You know, tonight. Just eating. We didn't have so much of the cigarettes and all of that in here then. I guess they had cleaned it up a little bit when we got here. But it was the food. And we just had food, food, food all the time.
What was the neighborhood like? Did you go somewhere for lunch and get stuff?
No, they would often send out to get food from someplace and bring it back, and we eat right in here. Yeah. Everybody would just eat together. And we just became sisters and brothers and friends. And you could get close to Leonard and Theo. They were quite personable with us. We thought we were somebody. They did too, because they treated us nice, not with the money, of course, but they did treat us nice with the food. And would get us a car, you know, that we spent all our life to pay for, because it was, you know, we had to pay it back. And the little money that we were getting from each record was just ridiculous. But so we stayed in the red quite a bit, but we thought we were somebody because we got the opportunity to travel, to go on the tours. And that's where we made most of our money, as we went on the tours. I think in here, the person that really, two people, that really had an impact on me was Billy Davis and Ralph Bass. They were A&R men, you know, Ralph was. And they kind of like put me in my veins where I was, realizing that I had that churchy voice, you know, that graspy churchy voice, because I came out of church from Birmingham. And so they, when they found I Had a Talk with God Last Night from Reverend James Cleveland, they bought every record, every album at that time that he had, and they went down all of the albums trying to find the next record for me. And we came up with No Faith, No Love off of James Cleveland's No Cross, No Crown. Then they went to That'll Be Good Enough for Me. We did that one until we ran out. And then they went back to My Babe, Don't Stand No Cheating and stuff like that. You know,
we should mention who Ralph Bass. He came up from King, right? Did the Chess Brothers bring him from King Records?
I don't know where. When I got here, he was here. So yeah. I don't know where they brought him.
I believe
from.
That's what happened. Right?
Did
right?
They?
Yes. Yeah, he was A&R man here, but he was with King before and had stories of discovering James Brown, right, bringing some of his early
mm-hmm.
recordings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But he was quite good.
And he was someone who helped us figure out what the studio was like. Awesome. He was mm-hmm. very much a help in going and recalling the equipment and how the studio worked.
For Jackie and Mitty, and you're talking about some of the challenges now that this is your responsibility, Jackie. What's it like for women to be in this business? And what was it like for you in the 60s, and how has it changed?
I know that it's still pretty much a male-dominated industry, and we try every opportunity we have to include women in our programs. When we do our summer programs of Blues in the Garden, it's actually the Record Row concerts. It started, and now it's the Willie Dixon Blues Festival. And we try to incorporate as many women as possible, but I still think that the majority of the musicians and the performers are men, and it's just unfortunately been that way for such a long time.
What was it like for you, Mitty, back in the 60s?
It was more or less, there were a lot of women here when I was here, but believe me, the one that had the clout was Etta James. She had all the clout. She had everything going for her. We would have to stop and be buzzed in down at the door. When she hit the door, it came open for her, you know. So that's the truth, but we had to be buzzed in. She was the queen bee of this place, and everybody respected her as that. And I don't care. I believe, and this is my belief, that if I had got the push that Etta got, my records, all of those would have been up like hers were and still are. But nobody got that push. Whatever we got, we had to get it on our own. One song that I did, Sharing You, it was a cover song from a young man who lived in Florida. And somebody called Rav and told them, we got just the song for Mitty. And they flew the song here because, you know, you didn't have all this internet and stuff like you got now. And they flew the song here, and I had to get up early in the morning. Well, when I got here, the band was here. The band knew the song already, and they just handed me a piece of paper. And I started singing, I don't know why I love you like I do. And when I got finished on my way home, it was on VON. You know, that's how fast it was. They had it going. They wanted to cover that song. That if they had done all of my songs like that, who, I would have really been somebody. But that was one that they did, and it went all over the country. And the interesting thing about it, I had a talk with my man. They put Billy Davis' name on it and Leonard Caston. And they didn't think it was going to do what it did. And Savoy Records heard about it. And they was getting rid of the sue chest unless they pulled that record back in and changed the label and put James Cleveland's name on that record. But they had to do that and call them off from all over the world where they had sent it and did it that way. So it's a bit different, I'm sure. Now, I don't do R&B anymore, but in the gospel field, like you were saying, it's the same way. It's dominated by men. Mostly, it still is. And that's what you're just always up against.
Tell us about your church.
My church.
More Like Christ Christian Fellowship Church on 82nd Street, right?
8201 yeah. South Dobson. Yes. It is now, we formed it in 2002. God gave it to me. And it was after my traumatic experience. You know, when I was on the road on my last tour, my voice tones began to drop. And I realized that something was happening, didn't know what it was, but I knew I couldn't party no more. I had to go and rest after every song, because every show, because we were out there like 40 days in a row, you know, traveling on the bus and whatever. And so when I got home, I went straight to the ENT, and they found out that I had polyps on my vocal cord. And so they were going to remove them with a laser. And they did remove them and told me to rest my voice for 6 weeks and I would be fine. And after 6 weeks, I came back to the doctor, and the doctor said, and all I could say was, nothing would come out. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't understand it because there was nothing wrong down there. But that was God dealing with me then to let me know it was time for me to let that go. And I did. I let it all go. And he gave me back my voice, actually, supernaturally, because what they did was not working. And as soon as I got on that side and accepted Christ as my personal Savior and began to walk with the Lord, I began to come back and sing. And I came in this studio with Gerald Sims, who was the guitar player. It was Jerem, G-E-R-I-M Records then, and I recorded a gospel album in it for it, but I think the young lady said that unfortunately he couldn't keep up the money, so he didn't have the wherewithal to put it out
there.
That
was who had the building before he
right. Right, right. Sims. That's right. Who it yeah. was, uh-huh. Gerald Sims. He was the guitar player yeah. in the band here. And so that unfortunately didn't go anywhere, but I've done a couple. And then I went to, in 2012, I went to Tokyo, Japan, and the Japanese recorded my very first, they paid for, we did it here in the States, my very first real gospel record that's going real well now. I owe it all to the Word.
And so you got service tomorrow?
I do at 11 o'clock, you all. I have service, and I have to go by another church on my way to my church because I started in 2016 featuring 12 pastors in concert. And this preacher said, how you gonna get 12 pastors together? Jesus couldn't get the 12 disciples together now. I said, well, that's because he's going to have to do it. But I did do that concert, and Dave, it was storming on the 29th of April, 2016, and Life Center Church of God in Christ on 5500 South Indiana Avenue was packed. It holds 1,200. It was packed. People were in there with wheelchairs and everything. They came, and 2017, last year, it was storming again. And the first year, it was the year of miracles. The second year, it was what love got to do with it. And all the songs pertained to love, you know. And so I went home and complained, and I said, I ain't doing this no more. What in the world? How come it have to storm every time these people coming out in the rain? And God spoke to me and said, you just hush, because you got your theme for next year, encouragement through your storm. So on April the 28th at Life Center Church of God in Christ, we will be there at 5 o'clock. In a concert production. It's not your regular run-of-the-mill concert. We don't have an MC that's talking between every song. When one person finishes, the other one got the mic to hit the stage, and we're going to perform 12. And this year, I got comedians. As a matter of fact, one of the young men who's a musician, he said, oh, I wonder if I can do my next album in here. I said, well, you heard next CD. I said, well, you heard us say you got to have some money. If you got some money, come on. We're going to hook it up. So he can do his. And he is a comedian, so we're featuring two of the comedians in his group, Wheeler and Frazier, so people can laugh. The way things are going now, we need to laugh some, you know. We really, really do. It's not all serious all the time, so we're going to do some singing, and I will close this concert out with my song called The Rainbow. The rainbow tells us that the storm is past.
Yep. Very good. Very good. Tim Samuelson from the city. You brought a Mitty Collier 40. Tell about your history. Okay. Tell us about the 45 you brought.
Well, I brought one of your original 45s. And so, in fact, one of the things that I always do is when I meet the people who recorded here, I impose on them to sign my records for me.
Which one was it? Which one?
Oh, so this is the one, the 1961 for the... Now I'm blanking out on my song.
We got to take a break.
Yeah.
So think about that, and we'll come back
live
from Blues Heaven on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal, live from Blues Heaven Chess Studios. We got a couple minutes before the news. So Jackie Dixon, president of Blues Heaven, tell us what's coming up, concerts, all the details.
Okay. Every year we've done the Chicago Blues Fest. We've had a booth actually, before it was even at Grant Park or Millennium Park, when it used to be at Navy Pier, mm-hmm. We used to go out and sell albums in the audience for my dad when he'd perform. So this
did
year,
you really?
Yeah,
back when I was
and no
drinking,
one tried
I
to kidnap us. Nobody wanted us, and so. But we this year, this is the first year we're going to not be at the festival. We're going to do. This is our 11th Hot Blues Night. So we've every year for since 2007, we do a show the night of the Blues Fest on the Saturday.
So garden right outside.
Right. Yeah. Or is it actually that Saturday show is inside.
Inside, okay.
But this year, instead of doing Hot Blues Nights, we're going to do a Hot Blues Weekend. So we're having our first show in the garden Thursday, June 7th, which is we're going to have a local performer. And then we have John Primer on the 8th, Wayne Brooks on the 9th for our show. Then on June 10th, we're going to do a tribute to and a fundraiser for Cash McCall. He was recently diagnosed with cancer.
Right.
So that's the beginning of our program. And then every Thursday from the first week of June through Labor Day, we have a concert in the garden. It's free, open to the public. It's from 6 to 7:30 p.m., and we have a different performer each week.
And how can people find out more about the organization? Give us the website, Facebook, all the social media.
Yeah, we got all the social media covered. We've got my nephew, Alex Dixon. Jackson, who's also a songwriter and a musician. He's our social media guy, so he tries to make sure we have a presence on Facebook, Instagram. He updates our website, and he's going to also list our garden schedule of all the performers that we'll have. We do my dad's birthday party on the Thursday closest to his birthday, so this year it's going to be July 2nd, and that's a three-hour show.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, we're going to take a break for David Jennings in the news, and we're going to come back. We're going to talk about the Chess Tour. We're going to have some more music from the Cashbox Kings, and we're going to talk to Gene Barge. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
So cloudy, I believe it's going to rain. So cloudy, so cloudy, I believe it's going to rain. I don't believe my woman loved me. She in love with another man. Yeah. Go look out at the weather. I believe it's going to be a flood. Oh, honey. Look out at the weather. I believe it's going to be a flood. I believe my woman gonna quit me, 'cause I can feel it all in my blood. Fellas, y'all make some racket. Come on. Can't you hear how the thunder roars? Woo! Oh, stop and listen. Can't you hear how the wind is blowing? I'm so blue and lonesome. Can't you hear how the wind is blowing?
Thank you. The Cashbox Kings. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720, live from the Lou's Heaven Foundation Chess Studios. Thanks a lot. That's a perfect song, a Muddy Waters song, right? Yep. Right, Joe? Okay. We're going to talk a little bit. We're going to pair up Janine Judge, the coordinator here at Blues Heaven, with our friend Gene Barge. Gene, it's good to see you.
It's good to be here.
Arranger, producer, tenor sax player. I want to talk about the tours and stuff, but you and I were here, you may not remember, in 2011.
Yeah, I remember.
And you looked around and you said, man, someday this could be a studio again. So here you are. It's going to happen.
It is?
Yeah, yeah. We were talking about that in the first hour. They're going to start recording here. Tell them, Jackie, it's going to be in June.
We're going to do our first recording in June, June 1st. We're bringing in our first artist, first week of June.
Who's going to be the artist?
I think it's going to be Big Lou. Yeah, local okay. Chicago artist. Yeah.
Very good.
So tell the listeners, and then we'll get into the tour. Who all did you work with here? Give us your resume.
Who did I work with?
Yeah, right.
Well, I got off the plane from Virginia, where
Norfolk,
where I lived.
Yeah, right.
And I got a job on the phone with Phil Chess. And when the Monday morning when I went to work, the first person that came in here was Oliver Sane. And that started a long list of people that I work with here at Chess. And on the piano for Oliver Sane was a lady named Fontella Bass. So that was my first day at work, you know. And after that, there's a whole list of Billy Stewart, Muddy Waters, Little Wilton, Hollywood. Minnie Riperton was a little girl in high school, carrying her books up here, hanging out. And the Sidney Barnes and Cash McCall was a young guy trying to make it on guitar. And it evolved that I worked with just about everybody on the Chess record. And I produced a lot of people. And I also play sax solo.
Yeah. Was Billy Stewart, was that one of the last sessions here?
Hmm?
Was Billy Stewart one of the last sessions done here?
No.
It was. Do you remember?
He was one of the last of the big sessions.
Uh-huh.
But we did a few things after that. I can't think of, because we moved in 67.
Yeah.
After the big snowstorm. But I can't think of some of the people, but we had so many people here coming and going, and it's hard to say.
How much has it changed? The space, just this, the building, yeah.
It's like, changed a lot because, for one thing, some years ago, Gerald Sims, our guitar player in our rhythm section, on this very floor, you know, this rhythm section that I played, I was in charge of. It was Maurice White on drums, who later went on to establish Earth, Wind & Fire. Louis Satterfield on bass, who later went with Earth, Wind & Fire as a trombonist. A guy named Bryce Robeson out of Michigan. Gerald Sims on guitar. And Gerald Sims ended up owning the building for a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this building, he bought it. And then Leonard Caston, he was the son of Papa Doo, mm-hmm. to play with Willie Dixon. And these were the guys that were in here on the floor at the time, you know.
Janine Judge, as coordinator, I've done it. You give a wonderful tour. I've always been surprised at your recall. Talk about, both you and Gene, talk about the tour, what people see when they come through here, any of the studio audience wants to come through. What all do they see?
Sure. I actually bring people through the building. With it being such a historic place, I start in the front lobby and talk a little bit about the neighborhood first, with it being Motor Row back then, and eventually becoming Record Row. So I start out front, and I go from everything from Minnie Riperton's song Loving You, pointing out that she was the receptionist, and walk all the way through the building, through the back shipping area, going through each exhibit back there, including Chuck Berry, Howlin' Wolf, and Bo Diddley. And I play a song from each artist as we walk through, including the Rolling Stones. I play several songs from their 12x5 album, which they recorded in this very room in 1964. I also bring the people upstairs. I start the Rolling Stones 2120 South Michigan Avenue before we ascend what I like to call the Stairway to Blues Heaven. And I make sure everyone rubs a little bit of that mojo off from that handrail, which I'm sure you, Mr. Barge, climbed those stairs many times. And people are just in awe of those stairs, and everyone wants to stop there and take a few photos. We then go into Willie Dixon's room, talk a lot about Mr. Dixon, Muddy Waters, Buddy Guy, and then we step into the studio. And as the acoustics change in this room, when people come through, you can just see people melt, and they're astonished that they're standing in the very spot where the blues actually kind of was broadcast to the rest of the world through the Chess Records, and therefore rock and roll. During my tour, I've also started playing some songs from other studios, just so that they compare the sounds of the different studios. It's been said by many musicians that they can never replicate the sound of this room with bass and drums, especially cymbals. And that's one thing I point out and come back to the Chess songs in hopes that people that do take the tour here are able to recognize when they leave this hallowed ground how much this room played a part in every Chess song, so they recognize those labels of the songs on the label. So I indeed feel honored and very privileged to be a part of this building. It's not a day goes by that I'm not overwhelmed by the sounds that came from this room. I play Etta James at the end of my tour. She's the only song that I play all the way through. At Last was recorded in this room, and I often look out in the audience, and people are wiping tears from their eyes, and sometimes I have to control my own emotions. I was very privileged to have met Etta James before she passed. And just again, the sounds that came from this room can sometimes be overwhelming to me as well.
Okay, we're going to come back. I want to talk about some other museum sites and stuff, things you may have learned from them. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
At last,
I get kind of nostalgic, and because Etta and I were very good friends, and this was done before I got to Chicago, and Ralph Bass was the producer. The arrangement was done by Riley Hampton, and then later on I got to do a couple of albums with Etta and a couple of things. We got to be really close friends.
You're 91 years old.
Yeah.
You should get a round of applause for that. I want to. So, thank you so much for coming out. You know.
Well, thanks for having me.
And one thing I want to talk a little bit in this segment is about the importance of music and community. And I want the listeners to know, you and I have talked before about some of your work with Operation Push and Breadbasket. People maybe don't know that chapter of your life. So
yeah,
talk about music and community, especially in Chicago today, too.
Well, music is a vital part of our American society, you know. And even a lot of the politicians were involved in music before they became politicians. The church played a big and important part. I saw Reverend Collier sitting in midi. And when she was in here, she wasn't a reverend, you know. She was trying to do her recordings. And so eventually she went into the church and became ordained. But going back to the music in general, you know, it plays such a big role in our society, you know. And it's a therapeutic situation, too.
Were there politics around here? I mean, when you did Push and Breadbasket, did you draw from talent here? How did you get those shows? They were at the International Amphitheater. How'd you put people together for those shows?
For shows?
Yeah, for the Push Breadbasket shows.
Well, what happened was Dr. King had appointed Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jackson, to come. He was already a year going to the seminary, and asked him to start an arm of SCLC and called it Breadbasket because he was seeing African Americans as we were broke. We didn't have we weren't a part of the financial mainstream. We didn't have enough money. We needed, our people needed more financial power. And so Breadbasket was supposed to be an organization that would try to trigger small businesses and whatnot to get into the financial mainstream and try to get our people working, earning a living respectably, and being in business, period. So the music played a big part. When he first tried to organize Breadbasket, he couldn't get the politicians to work with him. The guys that worked with him were musicians. So me, Ben Branch, Burgess Gardner, John Watson, all of those guys were musicians. And a lot of them were educators, music educators, like I was. I came from a classroom to Chicago in Virginia. So music education, the music educators came to help start this arm of SCLC, and that's what happened, you know.
For Janine and Jackie, I mean, that's one thing when we've always talked about what you're doing here. Can you talk about what you see in the community, what you see in the community right around the studio here, and what you have planned for outreach, especially with youth?
Okay, you know, when you first interviewed me years ago, you asked me what did I think of the condition of the blues community, and I said, you asked me, was it dead? And I said, it wasn't dead, but it was on life support. So I've seen it get better. I've seen it start to recover. There's definitely a growth and a push, and there's a lot more young people coming around that's learning more about blues as the origin of the music that they're the genres that they are interested in and that they're trying to establish themselves in. So I'm impressed with the way things are coming about. There's some key people, you know, here in Chicago that just keep pushing and keeping the interest and the focus on blues that I really appreciate, you know, the way that they work with the community, even though Chicago Blues Fest is doing more than I thought they used to.
You think that? Do you look at? We talked during the break. Do you look at what other cities are doing? Do you look? I know you've talked to Sun in Memphis, and I think Stax does a great job with community outreach. They have the Memphis Sim Collaborative, and they have the school there.
Right.
Do you look at models in other towns?
I do. You know, we have some different situations, whereas we're in our original location, and so we have the historical landmark consideration that doesn't allow us to do certain things that kind of limits us. And then also at the same time, we're nonprofit, and then I believe one of them is for profit, so they have a lot more resources to work with. But they definitely have a program that we can pattern ourselves after and model ourselves from.
Real quick, we got about a minute. Tell us about the tours, tour times.
Sure. I also just wanted to interject what Jackie said. We're hoping to utilize the new studio as well as internship programs for students to give them that opportunity to actually work within the Chess studio being rebuilt here. So, and I find that a lot of young people coming for tours are now able to recognize some of Willie Dixon's songs and how the blues are the roots and the rest are the fruits, as he said. In fact, there's several songs that are being used of Willie Dixon's currently. In fact, a commercial is currently out that you'll probably see tonight of one of his songs. So the tours are Monday through Saturday from noon till 4. We try to start every hour on the hour. We had to raise our prices this month after 25 years of remaining at the same price. So tours are $15 for adults and $10 for students, children. We do group rates as well if you want to give us a call. We also want to emphasize that we are taking donations. Any donations currently will go towards us to help rebuild this studio and bring music from this room again to the rest of the world. So please visit our website, bluesheaven.com. You can make donations through PayPal. We also accept checks, and there's also a box down on the front desk if anybody wants to leave donations here in the building.
Okay, thank you. We're going to take a break for David Jennings in the news, and we'll be back with more Cashbox Kings after this on WGN.
Hey, this is the Cashbox Kings. We're live from Chess Studios. It's an absolute honor to be here this evening. We're going to play a song, an original off our debut record on Alligator Records, Royal Mint. This is called Blues for Chirac.
One, two, three. what's gonna happen in my hometown.
Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. Joe, you want to take a mic? Introduce the band first, and then tell us about that sound. And Joe, you're the harmonica player, band leader.
Yeah, my name is Joe Nosek. I'm the harmonica player, band leader, sometimes vocals. Billy Flynn on guitar, John W. Lawler, upright bass, Kenny BDI Smith, drums, little Frank Krakowski on guitar, and my buddy here, Oscar Wilson, on vocals.
And tell me, Oscar, I want people to know, I mean, you're from 43rd Street. What's it like when you sing that song? Tell us a little about growing up there. Are you still there now? Quick bio.
No, I'm not there now, but not far. But yeah, I grew up there from 1953 on till 2007 when I moved to Wisconsin for a minute.
Oh, Wisconsin?
Yeah.
Okay.
Janesville.
Janesville.
Yeah.
That's been in the news lately.
Yeah.
Some of your neighbors, talk about, Honey Boy Edwards one of your neighbors?
Yes. You know, I kind of get confused when you say Honey Boy because we called him Mr. Honey Man. You know, and he used to come to my house, yeah, which my father was a blues man who happened to pass away 2 months before I was born. But they used to all come around. My mother would fry fish and stuff on Friday. Honey Boy, Big Smokey Smothers.
Smokey was the ice cream man, right?
He was the ice cream man.
Yeah, talk about that.
Oh, yeah, he'd come around on his bicycle wagon. We couldn't wait to see Smokey. Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, we called him Smokey and Ice Cream Man. And, you know, he happened to be my nephew's father. So... you know, that's how that went. But I mean, you know, when I was a little guy, and today I was on Facebook, I don't know, one of the guys that put the old stuff up, and he mentioned this guy, Alfred Blues King Harris. And I remember as a little boy hearing that name, but when I played this song, he used to be at my house. You know, it just come back because I was a little, you know, you couldn't be in there when they playing. But I was the little guy that stood at the door listening, you know, and get out of here, you know. But that's what I did. And I grew up with Honey's daughter, Betty. We all went to school together.
Kenny Smith, we were just talking about that. I called you to come in because he's talking about the house. And I've talked to you because you grew up next door to the Muddy Waters House, which is another important thing of Chicago history.
Yeah, that's actually true. I was actually born in that house first. I stayed in Muddy's house first. So that's actually was my birthplace was that house. And then we moved two doors down later, but I lived in that house, yeah.
4339 South Lake Park.
Absolutely.
I'm calling for Tim Samuelson, too, because him and I have been to the house many times as part of Chicago Preservation. How's the house doing? I haven't been there.
It's hanging on by a thread, but I'm really hoping that everybody's fighting for it, you know, fighting to keep it alive, and hopefully that it's a landmark, and I hope that they really do something with it. Everybody's fighting to keep it.
What were some
house.
Of the memories of that house for you? I mean, the food, the visitors.
Well, I remember being all the rehearsals was in the basement. I can remember all the rehearsals. I remember James Cotton. There was a lot of poker games, and I think that they were rehearsing, but I think it was a party in that basement because it was a lot of drinking, a lot of smoking, and it definitely was filled with cigarette smoke. I mean, and a few songs played here and there. Yeah.
And Muddy was there from what 54 to 73, and then he went to Westmont, right?
Yes, and then he went to Westmont, correctly. And then my father moved in that house right after that. Yeah.
Your father?
Yeah.
Who
played with my father, Willie B. Guy Smith.
Yeah.
He played drums with Muddy Waters, and then he moved there in that house. And I'm telling you, I've seen so many people come through their house. Before I knew they were legends, they were just like uncles and family to me. I've seen them that much on a daily basis, you know, and they... taught me a lot. They taught me a lot that I still hold strong to today. You know, they told me so many things, and they were so smart. They say, "Hey, I didn't do this, but you need to do this." And they would tell me that constantly, and that held true. That really still to this day still holds true.
That's why the education component is so important. Tim, we went there with Dan Long. We did some video for the station maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And we went up to the house, and I swear you almost had tears in your eyes.
Yeah.
You say it's one of the most the most important house in the city of Chicago?
I would say so. In fact, you often hear of the House of Blues. Well, that's the real House of Blues.
Yeah.
Everyone who was anyone walked through those doors because Muddy was Mr. Hospitality. And in terms of people staying there, hanging out, on a warm day, you go out in that front yard, and you could imagine on a warm day, it was a rehearsal room in the basement. You'd move out into the front yard, and it was a Muddy concert for the whole neighborhood. So it was a place of pride. He was so proud of it. And hung on to the house and even make sure that his friends would be able to stay in that house and to sort of really have hopes for being able to preserve it. Luckily, it's a sturdily built building, and so if it can make it through, we'll have one of the great houses of America.
Kenny, do people drive by? I know there's a marker in front of it, but do people, tourists come by and take pictures and stuff?
Absolutely. I see that on a daily basis. They'll come by. Rain, sleet, or snow, I've seen them out there taking pictures, even just to touch it. You can just see it in their eyes. It's just like, to them, you know, coming by. They absolutely come by all year long.
Why have you stayed in that neighborhood? Why have you stayed there?
First, my father would never move from there. I mean, it was that was his place. That was home. That was it. You know, that was his home. Everybody else stayed there too. I mean, you had Pee Wee Madison right across the street. We had Big Smokey Smothers. Oscar was talking about him earlier. He was the ice cream man because I bought ice cream from him too. You know, on his bike. You know, so I remember those artists just literally right across the street from me. It was a place of pride and for the musicians right there. You know, and it's got the history. You know, and it's engraved. It's engraved in all of those musicians. It's engraved in me too. You know.
Jackie, you've been on everybody's been on the show before. Why doesn't Chicago do a better job of promoting this stuff? I mean, right now, they call it Motor Row, not Record Row. VJ was right down the street.
I wish I actually had an answer for that. You know, unfortunately, a lot of times, even tourists will come here from overseas, from out of the country, and they know more about the Chicago history and Chess Records and the blues than people locally. And then we get people in local that come locally because they've seen the music during the summer or someone brought them down and they say, "I'm so ashamed, you know, I've lived in Chicago 50 years, I didn't know that this was here." So, like I said before, we've been, unfortunately, the best kept secret in town, and we're trying to get the secret out.
Okay, we got to take a break for some commercials, and we'll be back on Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
Got it.
Ticket. I got my load. Conductor hollering, all aboard. Take my seat, railway back. I'm gonna watch this train roll down the track. I've been thinking about the good time I once have had, y'all. Woo! Soul got happy, heart got glad. And I think about the way you love me too. You can bet your life I'm coming home to you. Baby. Oh, baby. I'm gonna bring it on home to you. I'm gonna bring it on home now. 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 Gonna bring it on home. Bring it on home to you.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal with the Cashbox Kings. Tomorrow night at Space in Evanston, right? Yep, tomorrow night at Space in Evanston. What time are you going on, Joe?
About 7:30. And we got a new record, relatively new record, on an Alligator Records, Royal Mint.
Okay.
CashboxKings.com.
Thank you so much. Jackie Dixon, that sounds like a Led Zeppelin song.
Don't they wish?
Yeah. So tell us a little about the history of that song and your dad's involvement.
Okay, that song was recorded by Sonny Boy Williamson originally for Chess, and then my dad recorded it on his Catalyst album in the 70s. And then it was recorded by a number of different rock artists, including Led Zeppelin. And, you know, a lot of times my dad would encourage artists to take his song and make it their own. And sometimes they would take them a little too literally. So that was one song that they definitely get recognized for. People associate that with them every time.
Your dad was an advocate of musician rights.
Absolutely. That's part of what the foundation was started for, because of the injustices and the practices that were perpetrated against him. And so he wanted to teach the business of music to artists so that they would learn copyright, publishing, licensing, and the business and how to protect their rights.
And how did that play in with the Chess Brothers?
Well, that was definitely a learning experience for everyone that was on the Chess label. Like we said, this was Record Row. There was over a dozen different record labels and distribution companies. So people were learning the same lesson in every studio on both sides of the street. And it's, you know, a lot of times even artists today, they know their craft, they know music, and they don't know business. So they entrust someone else to look out for their best interest, and that's not always the way it happens.
Okie dokie. Well, that's it. It's a take. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks for having us here. Thank you, Cashbox Kings. Give us one more plug for the website and how people can find out about
Go to bluesheaven.com. You can get our schedule for the garden, the tour schedule, find out what's going on with us. And if I got just 30 more seconds, there's a couple people I just need to say. Well, today was Muddy Waters' youngest son's birthday, Joseph Morganfield. So I wanted to give him a happy birthday. And I have to always say something to my godmother, who's Coco Taylor's daughter, Cookie Taylor. She's always been great to me, and she's really huge in keeping the blues alive here in Chicago.
So we're going to do this again?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you all for coming out. Thank you, Adam Phillips, Dan Long, Todd Manley, and Stephanie Menendez. Thank you very much.